The topic of my books has ever been the fate of old-world art and artists transplanted to the new world. Like Copland, Gershwin, and Bernstein, I have felt the need to figure out what it is to be an American. My fascination with cultural displacement and accommodation must say something about my own cultural condition. I am neither an immigrant nor the son of immigrants, but all my grandparents were born abroad within the Jewish pale of Russia and Eastern Europe. My wife was born in Budapest. I do and do not feel American. The classical music has been a lifelong personal passion, compounds my situation. Born in Europe, imported to the United States, it has since World War I occupied an increasingly odd and insular corner of the American experience. To be an American classical musician is a challenged vocation.
That's a passage from the prologue of Joseph Horowitz's book, Artists in Exile. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. As war and revolution forced many artists to flee Europe in the first half of the 20th century, America offered an opportunity for refuge and reinvention, a place author Thomas Mann called a foreign homeland. How did musical maestros from Germany, Russia, and elsewhere adapt to American culture without losing their identity in the process? What effect did African-American culture have on their attempts to create a new American music? What do we learn about America from studying how refugees influenced and were influenced by its musical culture? Joining me is Joseph Horowitz, former New York Times music critic, now a music scholar and concert producer, whose numerous books include Understanding Toscanini, Wagner Nights, Dvorak in America, and Classical Music in America. Today we talk about his acclaimed book, Artists in Exile, How Refugees from 20th Century War and Revolution Transformed the American Performing Arts. Welcome to University of the Air.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's a fascinating topic, and I was intrigued by your prologue, by your mention of your own background and how that made you fascinated in this topic of, I guess, figures who are straddling two worlds.
Well, I notice that if you look at a composer like Roger Sessions or Virgil Thompson, both of whom had generations upon generations of ancestors living in the United States, they weren't much concerned with what makes music American or making an American statement. But if you look at composers like Bernstein or Gershwin, not to mention immigrant composers, this question becomes as important to them as it seems to be to me. Without consciously intending to, I find that I've written 10 books, all of which puzzle over the question, who is an American? What does America mean? What kind of art is indigenous or should be indigenous to the United States?
And it's kind of ironic that so many Americans in the time period that you're looking at, the early half of the 20th century, have such inferiority complexes when it comes to the arts, where to be foreign is to be better. And you know, you point to that in your book, that some of it is a bit of showmanship, where if somebody looks like a foreign maestro, they will attract an American audience.
Well, this is a problem particularly in music. My book deals with dance, theater, cinema. These, if you're looking at cinema, it's a younger art form, so Americans don't have to feel this shadow being cast by Europe from abroad, whereas classical music is at the opposite extreme. The history of classical music in this country is a history of colonization. The colonizers were Germans. They started coming over before the middle of the 19th century. Orchestras came over. Individual musicians came over. German choral societies were formed. So when it came time for Americans, American-born musicians, to figure out how they could create a native musical high culture, this was pretty challenging. And in fact, it's an enterprise that never succeeded. I say that we have a mutant musical high culture. And what I mean by that is a normal musical high culture is one like in Russia or Germany or Italy or France, where there's a native canon, where the essential repertoire is native. Whereas if you look at our opera companies and orchestras, you'll see that we have no native canon. Sure, we have some pieces, but our canon is European. Mm-hmm. So we have a mutant musical high culture. and people who function within it have to function with that challenge in mind, and it's often in mind. I mean, for somebody like Gershwin or Bernstein or Ives, I think of Gershwin and Ives as our two greatest talents in American concert music, and they're both people who are very conscious of making an American statement, and they also are both people who very consciously made the decision not to go to finishing school in Europe. You can compare them to Melville. You can compare them to Whitman.
Maybe Mark Twain.
Mark Twain, Frederick Church. This is not Henry James, right? Mm-hmm. These are people who made a conscious decision that I'm going to ground myself in American culture for better or worse. And it's a signature of these great, iconic American originals. I find that there's something unfinished about the output, whether in music you're talking about Ives or Gershwin, or in literature you're talking about Melville or Whitman. That's somehow one of the things that makes them seem American and makes them not seem European.
What Whitman called barbaric yawp. One of the things, certainly the influences on Gershwin would have been African-American culture, which you write about in your book. And Langston Hughes notes in his first book of jazz that America did not have a music it could call its own until you had blues, ragtime, jazz, and spirituals. Can you talk about the influence that had on the people you talk
about? I talk in my book, Classical Music in America, about the jazz threat. It's one of my favorite sections in the book, because it's something I learned writing the book, and it took me entirely by surprise. If you look at Gershwin, this is maybe the most succinct way to identify what I'm talking about. You can look at Gershwin for a year, 2 years, 5 years, I'm talking about Gershwin reception history, and scratch your head until you lose all your hair, because all the people of Gershwin's generation who were important classical musicians, who admired and appreciated him, were European-born. They could have been people in the U.S. like Jascha Heifetz or Otto Klemperer or Fritz Reiner or Arnold Schoenberg, or they could have been people abroad like Shostakovich or Ravel. But if you look at the American-born musicians of that generation, and particularly thinking about Aaron Copland and Virgil Thomson, they feel the need to patronize Gershwin. Mm-hmm. And so in answer to your question, if you put jazz, say popular music, into this picture I'm drawing of a mutant musical high culture, what you find is a schism greater than any abroad. Jazz was America's signature creative achievement in music between the two world wars. And that was especially recognized abroad. So what does that mean if you're Aaron Copland? What does that mean if you're Virgil Thomson? It means you're really uncomfortable. And this discomfort was focused on one particular genius, Gershwin. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm writing a book now about Gershwin and Ruben Mamoulian, one of the immigrants in my book, Artists in Exile. When I wrote Artists in Exile, my great discovery personally was Ruben Mamoulian, who had just been a name to me. So who is Ruben Mamoulian? Well, hello. He directed Oklahoma. He directed Carousel. He directed Porgy and Bess. He directed the greatest of all Hollywood screen musicals, Love Me Tonight. He's an Armenian born in Tbilisi, what we now call Tbilisi in Georgia, who then goes to Paris and then goes to London. Completely deracinated figure. But he's schooled in Russian experimental theater, and that's what he brings to bear. Why Carousel? Why Oklahoma? Well, Mamoulian had worked with Richard Rodgers. Nobody makes these connections on the movie Love Me Tonight. I don't know how many people today know the movie Love Me Tonight. Go on YouTube and just click on Love Me Tonight, Isn't It Romantic? And you'll see a sequence integrating music and theater more amazing than anything in Carousel or Oklahoma. And that's where Richard Rodgers, I'm exaggerating, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of truth to what I'm saying, got the idea. Because when Mamoulian hired Rodgers and Hart over Oscar Strauss to do the music for Love Me Tonight, Richard Rodgers had no idea what he was in for. Mamoulian wanted a full score. He didn't want songs. And he wanted He didn't want merely songs, and he wanted those songs to be part of the genesis of the film, completely organic to it. And if there was a stag hunt, as there is in the film, he didn't want somebody else to fill in the pieces. He said to Rogers, "You're composing this also." So it's as a achievement in integrating film and music. It's as high an embodiment as anything I know. These are the germs for Porgy and Bess, for Carousel in Oklahoma. They come from this immigrant, Mamoulian.
And it's funny how we don't really know some of these people working behind the scenes.
He's the forgotten hero of American musical theater.
It seems to suggest that Americans couldn't do it without the foreign infusion because, I mean, in a certain way, wouldn't it reinforce a sense of American inferiority or a redefinition anyway?
It complicates. Does it enrich or complicate the American situation? Well, if you're Howard Hanson, Hanson actually wrote an article in the Times in the 1930s about the threat of the immigrant composers being such an overpowering presence that this nascent enterprise of creating an American school was derailed. And it's a very complicated question. There's no simple answer, but you can answer it sort of case by case, which is what I try to do in the book. I take an individual figure like Stokowski or Koussevitzky and ask, what did America do for them and what did they do for America? Let's start with Stokowski.
Sure.
Stokowski is, to my mind, a heroic figure.
Even though he kind of was a bit fraudulent?
Well, the thing I would say about Stokowski is that he's a self-invented fantasist. And the pertinence of Stokowski to this conversation is the phenomenon Stokowski could not have existed abroad. Because here, the land of Walt Disney and Hollywood, if he said that he was born in Poland and gave the wrong year and spoke in an accent that was untraceable, not only could he get away with it, but, you know, he's already Cary Grant or Charlie Chaplin, who reinvent themselves in Hollywood. Whereas if he were in Europe, since he was born in London, he could never have played this role in England. He could never have played this role in Germany. He certainly could never have played this role in Poland. I don't think he didn't even speak Polish. And he, in fact, was not born in Poland, even though he sometimes said that he was. So the self-invention of Stokowski is far more than just a personal self-invention. He's inventing from scratch his version of, say, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It doesn't, his version of Beethoven's Fifth, which we're about to sample from a 1931 Philadelphia Orchestra performance, it defies tradition. It doesn't link to any notion ever previously articulated about what Beethoven sounds like. For instance, if one signature of Beethoven is the subito dynamic, what does that mean? It's a sudden forte, you're suddenly loud, you're suddenly soft. Look at any Beethoven score. Stokowski never does subito dynamics. That's not part of his style.
Why?
Well, his style is based on the organ loft. He was an organist, and he likes the orchestra to sound like an organ. He likes to have a kind of lava flow of sound, and so he'll rewrite the music we're about to hear, the second movement of Beethoven's Fifth, which Beethoven says is andante, but which Stokowski makes an adagio. Is full of silences that Stokowski avoids. Either he'll rewrite note lengths so that there is no silence, or he'll glide in and out of those silences so they really don't register as such.
Isn't that a little nervy to take on Beethoven that way?
My point, in part, is that this act of nerve is one that really could only have been consummated in the New World. In the Old World, I think it would have been not only impossible in terms of the way it would be received, but Stokowski would never have had the impulse to do it at all in a more traditional musical environment.
So it's kind of the frontier spirit, break the rules, try something new,
yeah,
be and big and bold.
Yeah, and what he also did, as some of your listeners probably know, is he reseated the orchestra many times. So you didn't necessarily have strings in front and woodwinds and brass in the back. And he famously espoused free bowing. He didn't want his string players to bow in unison because it breaks the line. If you're the weight of the bow on the strings varies depending on whether you're going up or down and where you are in your motion. Whereas if everybody's bowing differently, you get this lava flow, which we'll hear. And so what I'm going to share with you now, not a well-known recording, an experimental recording of an experimental performance. This was Bell Labs at the Philadelphia Academy of Music in 1931, achieving a recording with a much broader dynamic range than was otherwise obtainable. And you need that dynamic range because when you hear the low strings sing their song at the opening of this movement, you'll hear a dynamic range broader than was ever applied to this music before.
It's got a very flowing, round sound that you can hear even in that old recording. There's something about it that's different. I see what you mean.
It's a performance unthinkable in Europe. And it's in America that he's able to invent himself daily, and more specifically in Philadelphia, where he takes an orchestra that's very young, unformed, gets rid of most of the players, and creates his personal instrument.
And how does he go from that to shaking Mickey Mouse's hand in Fantasia?
He goes directly from that to shaking Mickey Mouse's hand in Fantasia because, as you just mentioned, he's a democratizer. This is a part of America that suits him. Sure, he himself enjoyed fame, but I think you have to tip your hat that he really, more fundamentally, wants to make Beethoven famous. And he has no compunction about how to go about doing that. Absolutely none. You could fault him for his taste. You can't fault him for the aspiration. Philadelphia became confining for him. And more so. This was a very long tenure. These things don't happen today. But for a period of decades, the Philadelphia Orchestra was very rarely conducted by anybody but Leopold Stokowski. The guest conductor is a convention that's much more recent than we tend to realize. So at a certain point, he couldn't stand it any longer, and neither could the board and neither could the audience. It was just too much of Stokowski. Stokowski was ready to leave, and he knew exactly where he wanted to go. He wanted to go to Hollywood. He'd already made some films, like there's one with Deanna Durbin. I think that was his first film, in which he plays Leopold Stokowski. You have to realize that when he made Fantasia in 1940, he thought that would be the first in a series of such films. And when he went to Hollywood in the late 30s, he thought this would become his American base. He never imagined that his career had already peaked and that his greatest impact had already occurred in a city that seemed to him provincial. He coveted the New York Philharmonic. He never got that. And Disney, after one Fantasia, no, Fantasia was not a financial success. After one Fantasia, Disney had had enough. So it turns out that Disney's notion and Hollywood's notion Stokowski was also at the Hollywood Bowl of popularizing culture was not Stokowski's notion.
We're going to look at more composers, conductors, and performers who crossed the Atlantic and changed American music when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. When in the projection room or through the operator's little window, I am watching the picture unroll. When I am sitting at the piano improvising or inventing themes and tunes. When I am facing the orchestra conducting my music, I have the feeling that I am giving my own and my best. Symphonically dramatic music which fits the picture, its action and its psychology, and which nevertheless will be able to hold its own in the concert hall. Never have I differentiated between music for films and that for the operas and concert pieces. That's a comment by Eric Korngold in 1940. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest on University of the Air, Joseph Horowitz, the author of Artists in Exile, How Refugees from 20th Century War and Revolution Transformed the American Performing Arts. We were talking about Stokowski and his work with the Philadelphia Symphony and then going to Hollywood, which was kind of not so successful for him in some ways. Now, with Korngold, you have quite the success, right?
He thrives in Hollywood. And this is one of the most paradoxical stories that I tell. Korngold is an opera composer, and he's a famous prodigy. His most famous opera, Die Tote Stadt, which we still hear today, he composed when he was 22 years old. Think of that. That was an international triumph.
And he was from Germany?
He's in Vienna when he composes Tote Stadt, and it's the Anschluss in 38. He's Jewish, that drives him with his family, his father being a famous music critic, to the United States. And his adaptation is seamless because by 38, he's a very old-fashioned, famous European composer whose style is essentially late romantic. And had there been no Second World War, Korngold, one would have to imagine, would have been marginalized as a creative figure abroad. He's a perfect fit for Hollywood. The Korngold style becomes the Hollywood style, this kind of upholstered romantic music full of leitmotifs, which becomes a signature of Hollywood glamour. And remember that movies in those days often played in very, very large movie palaces.
And just to emphasize, that leitmotif would be a musical theme that would come maybe in association with a character,
right?
Or a
just
a mood.
As in an opera. The paradox here is that what you just read, Korngold is telling you the truth. His opera style in Vienna and his movie style in Hollywood, it's the same style. So if you're watching, Robin Hood, famous Errol Flynn film scored by Korngold, doesn't sound British. It sounds Viennese. If you're watching King's Road with Ronald Reagan, it's a steamy melodrama in the American Middle West, the music sounds Viennese. In fact, that particular score, which was the fanfare from which was played at Reagan's first inauguration, begins with a theme and variations, just the kind of thing that Korngold would implant in an opera. And this is a typical Korngold move. The theme is the fanfare, which is used when you scroll the titles. And then there's a series of scenes which are distinguished both narratively and musically. And the way they're distinguished musically is that this is a sequence of three variations with a coda based on the fanfare. So his operatic style, his cinema style are one and the same, and the paradox is that he couldn't have continued writing in that style in Vienna, but he could, being transplanted to Hollywood as a prestigious European. And he was prestigious because Hollywood knew he was famous.
Mm-hmm.
He was already famous.
Famous, but he wasn't doing something avant-garde and hard on the ears like Schoenberg or Hindemith.
Right.
Yeah, he was doing something more parlor music sound, I guess. Well, what made his music then American other than that he had adjusted it to fit the movies?
Nothing.
I mean, nothing, just the medium, not the music.
A favorite sentence from my book reads, like Garbo's accent or Stokowski's hair, Korngold's music was understood to confer an old-world pedigree of quality, as did Korngold himself with his glossy operatic credentials and Central European English. People like Copland and Thompson reacted, and they said, Hollywood film music should sound American. And Copland took action. He collaborated on a film for the 39 New York World's Fair called The City. I think it's actually his highest achievement as a film composer, but he did that partly as a strategy to show Hollywood that he could score a film, and it worked. And Copland scored a bunch of Hollywood films. He even won an Academy Award for The Heiress, which is a film version of Henry James' Washington Square, which you probably know. Mm-hmm. He scored Of Mice and Men. He scored Our Town. He scored The Red Pony. And at a certain point, he decided he couldn't stand it any longer, and he went back to New York. Ironically, it was the score for which he won the Academy Award, The Heiress, that most upset him because of the way that it had been edited and changed. But what he brought to Hollywood was and he was very explicit about this, an anti-Korngold style, no leitmotifs, no upholstery, a lean American sound, and it influenced Hollywood. Even those Hollywood composers like Dmitri Tiomkin, who were immigrants, were able to adopt it. And we think of it perhaps first and foremostly as a Western, the style for Hollywood Western films. I once heard Andre Previn, who was an immigrant in Hollywood, as a kind of wunderkind conducting and scoring, talking about the influence of Copland. Fewer notes, he said. Copland's influence on Hollywood was fewer notes.
And how much did the sort of commercial motive figure in here? In other words, when Korngold made the decision to go to Hollywood and write the music for various movies, whether it's Robin Hood or others, mm-hmm. how much of that was because that's where the money was? And how much of it was that he genuinely liked the work and felt equally proud of it as if it had been performed in Carnegie Hall?
It's a slippery question with Korngold. I once met somebody who knew Korngold, Felix Galimir, a violinist from Vienna, who said that Korngold had the personality of a child. And this is what one senses from his music, from his operas, from his film scores. I think he really enjoyed those Errol Flynn films. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he made a resolution that when Hitler was overthrown, he would return to Europe and return to writing concert music. He was sufficiently naive that he didn't realize that he would not return to Vienna as a conquering hero. He would instead return to Vienna as an anomaly, as an incongruity, somebody who had no relationship to contemporary music as it was experienced in the 1950s.
And did he feel like an American by this point? I mean, you know, you talk about some of these immigrants who never quite felt American. In other words, Toscanini is buried in Italy, never became an American citizen. Others who really, you know, they took on citizenship and they felt American.
I can't answer that question. All I can tell you is that he went back to Vienna thinking he would receive a hero's welcome, and he wrote a big symphony. And we're going to hear the opening of the scherzo of that symphony because it encapsulates this paradox of Korngold. See if you don't think this sounds like music that John Williams may have written for the movie Superman. So, yeah, I guess you could say Korngold did become an American because when you hear John Williams, you're hearing Son of Korngold.
So this is going to be Korngold, the scherzo from his symphony.
Right. Thank you.
It does sound like movie music. And it sounds American in many ways, even though you're saying it's transported, but there's something about it. Maybe it's just because of all the movies we've heard.
Who knows? The slow movement from the symphony is a dirge for FDR. Oh, the immigrants loved FDR. This mm-hmm. is an amazing topic. Schoenberg's Ode to Napoleon and Kurt Weill's Whitman songs are both inspired responses to Pearl Harbor. The American patriotism of these immigrants is something very special and very moving. I had occasion to talk to a member of the original cast of Oklahoma. We were talking about Mamoulian before, the Russian director of Oklahoma. And it was his idea to interpolate into the show this big number, Oklahoma. And if you remember the number Oklahoma, it's about the wheat in the fields, and we know we belong to the land, and the land you belong to, we belong to is grand. And I was told that Mamoulian's fervor conveying these lyrics to the cast of Oklahoma, something only a grateful immigrant could have felt. I think Schoenberg's Ode to Napoleon is one of his highest achievements. This is a Jewish immigrant reacting to the news that the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor, somebody already highly predisposed to worship Roosevelt. He takes a poem by Lord Byron, which is about Napoleon, the evil Napoleon, and Byron's poem, as you may know, you're a professor of mm-hmm. English, ends with George Washington. It ends with this heroic reference to Washington as the rare military commander who does not become a political dictator. So Schoenberg's fervor setting the Ode to Napoleon for narrator, string quartet, and piano produces a piece full of rage and full of exaltation, an immigrant's response to the news that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Similarly with Kurt Weill, he sets three Walt Whitman poems, one of which is O Captain, My Captain. And Weill is much more of an assimilator than Schoenberg. He comes an opera composer to the New World and decides, I'm not composing for the Metropolitan Opera. That's like Europe.
Three Penny Opera has to wait a long time to get its popularity back.
During Weill's lifetime, people don't know Three Penny Opera in the U.S. He dies in 1950.
He would probably have been happy to know that it replaced Oklahoma as the longest-running musical on the stage, right? Because didn't he call Oklahoma sort of a hillbilly piece or something?
There you go. Yes. He and Rogers were very much competitors. And the references to Richard Rogers in the correspondence between Lottie Lenya and Kurt Weill are pretty ugly. They didn't like Oklahoma. Anyway, Weill became a Broadway composer. And, you know, he wrote a Broadway opera called Street Scene, Lady in the Dark, One Touch of Venus were both successful. Lost in the Stars, directed by Ruben Mamoulian, not so successful. These works, the Whitman songs, are not known at all, but they're remarkable in creating a musical language that mediates between the Germany that he came from and the Broadway that he knew.
Well, and with Street Scene, he used words by Langston Hughes, right? He collaborated with Langston Hughes and got a Tony for that work. It's not well known now, though.
It's getting more and more performed. Weill is somebody who's a chameleon. He's very dependent on his collaborators. His greatest collaborator was Bertolt Brecht. But he looked hard. I mean, he used Maxwell Anderson. He used Langston Hughes. He used Ira Gershwin. We're going to hear one of the Whitman songs sung by Tom Hampson, or at least a little bit of it. So this is Kurt Weill responding to Pearl Harbor.
The last sunbeam lightly falls from the finished Sabbath on the pavement here and there beyond it. it is lurking down a new-made double grave. Now the moon ascending up from the east, the silvery round moon, beautiful over the housetops, ghastly phantom moon, immense and silent moon.
You write in your book, no ventriloquist could rival the alacrity with which Weill assimilated the lexicon of American voices flavoring these scores. What kind of assimilation do we hear in what we just heard? Tell us what that was.
Yeah, what you're hearing here with Weill setting a Civil War poem by Walt Whitman is somebody creating, I would say, a new genre, the American art song, something in between a German lead and a Broadway ballad.
It sounds very different from the Mack the Knife.
Oh, yeah,
that
let's listen to
signature.
Lottie Lenya.
Well, and help us place how Mack the Knife would have fit sort of chronologically with the Whitman that we just heard.
Well, Drei Groschen Oper, Three Penny Opera is from the 20s? God. Yes, I'm sure it's from the 20s. What we just heard is 1942, but more fundamentally, the first work is German, mm-hmm. and the second is American. Here's a composer who really reinvents himself, not a Schoenberg, not a Bartok, not a Hindemith, not a Stravinsky, but a guy who comes to New York and decides in 1935, I'm an American, and I'm going to adapt a new musical language. This is what Weill sounded like with his wife, Lottie Lenya, in her most famous role, as the composer of Drei Groschen Oper, Three Penny Opera.
So this occurred Weill before coming to America and changing himself. You quote in your book from the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, David Drew's article that says Kurt Weill is perhaps the only one to have done away with his old creative self in order to make way for a new one.
An amazing attempt. And it's fascinating that he regarded, or at least he said, he regarded street scene as his highest achievement. In other words, looking back at his career in Germany and France and the United States, comparing Three Penny Opera with street scene, he thought street scene. This is it's an interesting question because very few people would agree with this. But, you know, he had distanced himself from Brecht and he'd become an American and he'd become a wholesome American. And if I had to guess, I would say that he looked back at his Berlin years and the kind of bitterness that he acquired as a chameleon from Brecht, not to mention the politics that he acquired from Brecht. And here's Brecht in the U.S., kind of an unsavory character who doesn't fit in. I think he liked street scene partly because he thought it was a more wholesome piece. And I think when he became an American, he adopted the notion that America was going to, if not save the world, at least it was a place where there would never be a Hitler.
And he said it's a place where you can hear Porgy and Bess, noting it's a great country where music like that can be written and played. Back in a moment with more University of the Year. The future music of this country must be founded upon what are called the Negro melodies. This must be the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. When I first came here last year, I was impressed with this idea and it has developed into a settled conviction. In the Negro melodies of America, I discover all that is needed for the great and noble school of music. They are pathetic, tender, passionate, melancholy, solemn, religious, bold, merry, gay, or what you will. It is music that suits itself to any mood or any purpose. There is nothing in the whole range of composition that cannot be supplied with themes from this source. That's the composer Dvorak talking to the New York Herald in 1893. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Joseph Horowitz, and we're talking about Artists in Exile, how refugees from 20th century war and revolution transformed the American performing arts. You open with Dvorak in your prologue. Why Dvorak?
Because I'm obsessed with Dvorak. Dvorak, to me, is such a heroic figure. And he forecasts the experiences of these immigrants, even though he's not an immigrant, he's a visitor, 1892 to 1895. And what he specifically forecasts is their take on black culture. Dvorak probably never met a black man before he came to New York in 1892. He certainly did not know the songs that he soon heard, like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and Deep River. He heard those songs and he said, wow, that's great music. He pedigreed those songs as no American could, and I would even go so far as to say he was more impressed by them than any American could be because they caught him completely unawares. The same thing happened, by the way, to the composer Frederick Delius about the same time in Florida when he heard the songs of black field hands coming across the water in Orlando where he was running an orange plantation. And it changed his life, these two epiphanies. I was not prepared to find this to be such a dominant theme when I undertook this book about immigrants in the performing arts. I'll just give you a few EGs. We were just listening to some Kurt Weill. Mm-hmm. Weill already in Berlin wrote about jazz as a musical genre that would transform music internationally and furnished a kind of an ideal for the future. Lost in the Stars, his black musical setting Cry the Beloved Country by Alan Payton, was directed by Ruben Mamoulian, who we've been talking about, starring Todd Duncan, who had been Porgy in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, directed by Mamoulian. But the most amazing example is Cabin in the Sky with Ethel Waters, a black musical, very successful, with a score by Vernon Duke, also known as Dukelski, born in Russia, directed by George Balanchine, born in Russia, with sets by Boris Aronson, born in Russia. And Porgy and Bess, the conductor Alexander Smolens, was born in Russia. The set and costume designer Sue Dekin, part of the Diaghilev group, born in Russia. What's going on here is exactly what happened with Dvorak. Balanchine, you know, was a big admirer of Josephine Baker. And dance authorities, of which I am not one, have written about the contributions of African-American dance to Balanchine's own distinctive choreographic style. Otto Preminger, born in Germany, was a leading figure in integrating Hollywood He directed Porgy and Bess. He directed Carmen Jones, Douglas Sirk. Same was true. Fritz Lang wanted to be, but it was an idea too soon. So what these people recognized was what Dvorak recognized. It wasn't just that African Americans had a very potent culture. It was that somehow that culture was at the core of American cultural identity.
And it was unique, absolutely original, in a way that sort of things that were music that was imitating European art was not. In other words, if you add the syncopated rhythm and the blues notes and some of the influence from Africa, it's going to combine that and then with some European instruments and melodies, it comes up with a hybrid that's different than anything else in the world.
The realization took many forms. It could take the form that you just expressed, or it could take the form of appreciating African-American performers. I mean, one of the reasons that Gershwin wanted to set the novel Porgy was that he felt if he was going to write an opera, he wanted to have a black cast because black speech was musical. And blacks, as he experienced them in Harlem, were particularly prone to sing as opposed to speak. And Mamoulian had the same reaction to his black cast.
Do you think also there was a sort of some sense of sympathy with people who are on the margin, people who are oppressed by mainstream?
Well, this brings us back to Dvorak. Dvorak is a butcher's son. He's part of a minority within the Habsburg Empire. He talks about it. He identifies with the disenfranchised. He says, I look to the poor for greatness. So it's partly that too. And of course, it's partly just a complete absence, or let's perhaps say a relative absence of racial prejudice.
Well, and also just it seems as if sometimes it takes Americans going across to Europe to be recognized, that foreigners see something of merit that sort of native-born Americans can be blind to.
Gershwin.
Yeah. One of the themes running through your book is the difference in how Russian immigrants versus German immigrants respond. You sort of make the case that the Russians are better at assimilating to American culture than the Germans, who are more like colonizers.
I didn't start out with this observation. It just hit me over the head many times. The Germans have their own cultural Bible. They might not even come from Germany. They might come from Austria. They might come from part of what is now the Czech Republic. But Beethoven and Goethe, what did Thomas Mann say? Where I am is Germany, or something to that effect. So the most extreme example is George Sell, who's conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. And I say in my book something to the effect that for his purposes, his musicians were Calibans who needed to be taught Mozart. Rudolf Serkin's Marlborough is not about American music. It's about German music.
So you're talking about the festival, the summer festival,
yeah,
that he sets up.
Right.
But the music is all to be German.
Yeah, he has an enormous influence in implanting German chamber music in the United States. But if you look at the Russian Koussevitzky and his festival, Tanglewood, it's not about Russian music. It's about American music. So why are the Russians different? Well, certainly if they pass through St. Petersburg, they've passed through a city very different from Berlin. Berlin is a German city. St. Petersburg is a city, if you've ever been there, that's just all cockeyed. It looks like it's in the wrong place. The buildings are the wrong color. The temperature is wrong. And it has a long history of people speaking French, German, English. The court spoke French. The important cultural figures in St. Petersburg might have been Petipa, who was French, or John Field, who was Irish, or there were Spanish composers there. There were Hungarian violin pedagogues. I'm thinking of Leopold Auer. So this is already a deracinated international environment. And sure enough, when the Russians come here, which I just mentioned Koussevitzky, his mission is to find the great American composer and to perform the great American symphony. And Tanglewood, the festival that he founds in the Berkshires, is devoted to that enterprise. Copland teaches there. And
Also some immigrants like Hindemith.
Hindemith, Bartok, Martinu are also important. Stravinsky, parts of the Koussevitzky story. What we're going to hear now is the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra in its broadcast premiere. Koussevitzky is dedicated to new music, not just American music. Bartok is in America. Bartok is in New York in a hospital dying of leukemia. And Koussevitzky goes to Bartok and he says, I want you to write a piece for the Boston Symphony. And Bartok says, sorry, too late, I'm dying. Koussevitzky says, no, you're going to write me a symphony. And it was actually a rejuvenating experience. He ultimately did die of leukemia, but he had a sort of second wind. And he wrote a piece called the Concerto for Orchestra, which Koussevitzky typically decided, this is the greatest piece of music of the 20th century. This is as great as a Beethoven symphony. And his act of advocacy was such that he did something that you never encounter today. He performed it on subscription, and then a few weeks later, he performed it again on subscription. And the second time he performed it, it was broadcast. We're going to hear the opening of this broadcast premiere performance, not least because it's maybe the best performance ever recorded of the Concerto for Orchestra. You can really hear the magnificence of Koussevitzky's strings. If there's time, I'll just tell you one anecdote. Bartok, of course, goes to Boston, and Bartok is a very fastidious man, maybe an Asperger's personality, who would study a beetle for hours, and he's taking copious notes, pages and pages of notes. Then he goes into Koussevitzky's dressing room with his notes. They're there for some period of time, and they emerge. Koussevitzky mounts the podium to resume the rehearsal, and he says, Mr. Bartok, he says, everything okay. So here's this everything okay performance, or at least the beginning of it, the broadcast premiere of Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra with Koussevitzky conducting his Boston Symphony.
That's from Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, commissioned and conducted by Koussevitzky, a Russian-born immigrant, and performed by the Boston Symphony. That was a live broadcast premiere from December 30th, 1944, and a good example of artists working in exile. My guest has been Joseph Horowitz, the author of Artists in Exile, which was named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. Thanks for being my guest.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.